Anthony Castrovince, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Thanks for having me, Ron. I appreciate it.
As we were saying a minute ago, I'm not a huge analytical fan because math was never a real strong subject for me at school, but I really enjoyed your book. And as you can see, it's heavily notated, so yes. I can easily get to any section on any of the statistics that you list in here. When I was a kid, we had the argument, what would you rather be? Would you rather be a 300 hitter? This is like for a 15, 20 year career. Yeah. Would you rather be a 300 hitter, or would you rather have, in those days, 40 home runs was a lot.
So right.
40 home runs and 100 RBI every year. So I was in the 40, 100. But okay. More and more lately, we are learning that the old statistics are not indicative of a player's value or quality, especially like the old standby. You have a chapter in here about the MVP race between Mike Trout and Cabrera, where Cabrera won the Triple Crown that year.
Right.
But you show through these statistics, these new age statistics, for lack of a better word, that Trout actually had the superior season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a big turning point, I think, even in my own understanding of the advanced metrics as I've covered Major League Baseball for the last, 16, 17 years, because we tend to gravitate towards the big, gaudy offensive numbers, as you did when you chose 40 and 100 as a kid. But then we see other ways to measure a player's value, and then also, as you pointed out, different stats are going to have different value in different years. I mean, 40 home runs is different in 1992 than it was in 2019. They're two very different eras in terms of home run production in the league. And then, the Mike Trout versus Miguel Cabrera was a big moment, I think, for wins above replacement to take a step forward in the national conversation, because it was a stat that did a very good job of demonstrating why Trout was the more valuable player that year, in that he did everything well. Offensively, he really wasn't far behind Miguel Cabrera's offensive performance. And then you add in the defensive component that he was providing the Angels in center field and the base paths. And it's interesting now because Trout, he's probably slipped defensively, and he's not as aggressive on the base paths as he once was. So a lot of his value is now tied up in offense, much like not exactly like Miggy Cabrera back in the day, but he's kind of graduated to that stage of his career. So I just think it's important to take the full context of a player into account, and also take the era into account, because, different numbers are going to mean different things in different years.
So let's get right into it. WAR, wins above replacement.
Yeah.
That seems to be the go-to stat these days for judging players. But there's not even an agreement on how to calculate WAR.
Right.
So you can understand the frustration with some people like me. I looked at some of the things like, I forget the name of it, but Palmer and Thorne wrote a book 30 years ago, which was released a couple of years back, that takes a lot of these numbers into account. And I always wondered how they come up with these formulas. How do they say that something is 0.65 instead of 6.8? Or I'm sure the people who are mathematically inclined have done deep studies on this and say, yes, this is it. This is the number that we should be using. But talk a little bit about some of the other statistics. One of the things that amused me, I think, the most was WOBA. And I actually looked to make sure that there was no radio station with those call letters. Because you say what the statistic is and what is not. And what it was not for WOBA was a radio call letter station. So,
I suppose it could be. Some radio station might want to jump on that for the the saber metric nerds out there. It could be a channel where all you do is discuss baseball stats. But that's a fun one, and I think that's part of why the advanced stats don't catch on with certain audiences, is because they do have these silly names that we just don't gravitate towards them as much. WOBA being one of the silliest and funniest, and I don't even know if WOBA is how you pronounce it. I'm just assuming it is, because it's the most fun way to pronounce it. I mean, WOBA is not nearly as fun to say as WOBA.
No, so, you have to have acronyms to say these things.
But the book takes you on a progression, and WOBA being a big part of that progression, because you know, batting average can be empty. You know, you can build a 300 plus batting average largely on singles, and it takes a grand slam that goes to the second deck counts the same in batting average as, you know, a little you know, dribbler in the infield that you beat out for an infield single.
So excuse me 1 second. I mean, it's my fault. What is WOBA?
So WOBA adds weight, and that's actually what the little W in the front means. It's a, for those who don't see the stat spelled out here, it's a small W and then a large OBA. And the small W means weighted, and that's what it does. It puts weight on different outcomes. So a walk, a hit by pitch, singles, doubles, triples, homers, any way you can get on base are included in weighted on base average in WOBA. But doubles are going to count more than singles. Triples are going to count more than doubles. Homers are going to count more than triples. And so that's why I think it's an important kind of a stepping stone stat. As I take you through the book, you know, you kind of graduate as you read the book. We start out talking about batting average and how it's really not the best offensive measure to player for the very reasons I mentioned. There's a lot of things that can happen in a plate appearance that aren't even considered in batting average because they don't fall under at bats, and that being, you know, walks and hit by pitch, the like. And then on top of that, as I said, a single counts the same as a home run. So you take weighted on base average, and now the outcomes start to matter. And because I think we could all agree that a double does more to generate offense for a ball club and put them in a better position to score a run than does a single or a walk. So that's what weighted on base average does. And then from there, you graduate to the other offensive stats that start to take the league context into account, like I mentioned earlier, and how, you know, how the league is performing in general in a given season adds different weight to what a home run means in a given season. 30 home runs won't mean the same 1 year as it does the next necessarily. So, as you read the book, you kind of build up a tolerance to all these things, and there's kind of a steady progression, kind of a domino effect. And then you close with wins above replacement, which, as you mentioned, Ron, there's no question about it. It is definitely, you know, a controversial stat, I guess you could say. It's kind of difficult to put all your eggs in the WAR basket, as it were, when they do have different calculations from different sources. And I totally agree with that. And I would never argue that it's a perfect stat, but I think when you read the book, you gain appreciation for, you know, what it means to have a total calculation of a player as opposed to just a small snapshot in batting average or home runs or RBI. It's important to have the defensive component involved. It's important to have the base running component involved. And WAR for now is the only stat that does that for us. And imperfect though it may be, it's miles beyond what we used to have in terms of evaluating a season.
And I guess, you know, if a stat's really important is if it shows up on the back of a baseball card. Because WAR is now in baseball cards, WHIP is now in baseball cards. But yeah, that's a good point, is that it's a progression in the book from, I guess, the most easily grasped concepts to the more, for me anyway, difficult concepts.
Right.
Because
right.
Not only do you have the small W for the weighted, but then you have pluses and minuses.
Yes.
And talk about how that throws a monkey wrench into the works.
It does. And I love the plus stats personally. Those are the ones I have come to, you know, they've become my first line of defense, I guess, when I'm seeing what kind of a season a guy is having. Is I want to see the plus stats. And what plus means is that's where I talked about adding context to, you know, what's going on in the league or in the ballpark. That's what the plus stats take into account. And so we're talking here about, listen, we've always evaluated pitchers based on their ERA, right? And you know, under 3 ERA is very good. But again, if you're in 1968, the year of the pitcher, you know, a 3 ERA is very different than 2000, the height of the offensive, you know, steroid era. Two very different things. So what the plus stats do is take that into account, and they relate everything to a league average. And the ones I look at, ERA plus and OPS plus, that's for pitcher, ERA plus for offensive players, OPS plus, 100 is the league average. And then anything above or below that is reflected in your stats. So if you have a 120 ERA plus, you were 20% better than the league average in that particular year. I think that does a better job than just looking at a player's ERA, because again, we don't necessarily know what the context of the season was. I Bob Gibson's 1968 was incredible. I would argue that Pedro Martinez at the height of the steroid era was even more incredible because he was putting up numbers that were absurd relative to the ball flying out of these, you know, smaller ballparks. So it was just a different time for those two guys.
So that's two things you brought up that I want to expand upon, because I'm looking at your chapter on expected batting average, expected slugging percentage, expected on-base, weighted on-base average. And you write how, and I'm going to read here, Gio Gonzalez pitched six scoreless innings for the Nats, and the only moment marring Lance Lynn's six and a third innings of work was the Bryce Harper ground ball that squeaked by to score an early run. That's amazing how our expectations have diminished. I mean, when you talk about someone through six innings and it's a big deal now, and you talk about Gibson and you look at how many complete games people like Gibson, people like Koufax, people like Seaver threw in a season, and you take like one of those guys and that's more than all the games, complete games combined these days.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the key point of the book for me. So this book is not making any, I'm not advocating any particular strategy. I'm not even trying to explain any particular strategy. Right now in baseball, there's a huge conversation about what happened in Game 6 of the World Series where, Blake Snell is cruising against the great Dodgers lineup, and then he's pulled the second the Dodgers are coming up that third time through the order. Kevin Cash is out there to give him the hook because the stats say that, you know, he struggles the third time through the order, even though he had dominated those same guys who were coming to the plate in that particular inning. So I can't advocate that. I think I would have rather seen Blake Snell try to pitch through that and try to pitch his team to Game 7 of the World Series. That would have been great fun. But, you know, the game is always changing. The way it's managed is always evolving, and there are shifts, and there are shorter leashes for starters, and there's bullpenning, and there's openers. There's all kinds of different strategies that are employed now, and it's going to continue to evolve in the years to come. And the point of the book is just to have a very stable framework to work off of for evaluating players no matter what changes occur, you know, because it's not, you can't just look at a guy's innings total anymore and say, well, he didn't pitch 200 innings, so he didn't have a very effective season. It's just not the case anymore. If it's a Blake Snell who won the Cy Young a couple years ago where, you know, Kevin Cash was managing him about as aggressively as he did in that World Series, he had no chance of getting to 200 innings, and yet he still had a very strong season relative to the rest of the league. And there's ways to account for that. So, you mentioned the expected stats. We talked about the little W is the weighted, the little X is expected. That's kind of another level we've reached here just in the last 5 years with the StatCast metrics that we have available at MLB.com, where you used to say a guy's hitting into bad luck. He's hitting balls hard, but he's hitting them right at people. Well, now we can look at that and we can see that, okay, when a guy is hitting a line drive with that exit velocity at that launch angle, it's a hit X percent of the time. And so here's what his batting average should be. Here's what his slugging percentage should be based on the traditional outcomes of the way he is hitting the ball. So That's just become just another level to evaluate a player and to see what guys are maybe hitting into bad luck or maybe what guys have fortune in their favor in a given season. So all this stuff just helps us, again, just get a better grasp of what we're watching, what we're looking at.
I want to read a little bit from your epilogue when you're wrapping these things up. I do wonder if the biggest revelations and revolutions in the world of baseball metrics are mostly behind us. These days, you can be a 230 hitter, but your value can be finally articulated and widely understood in other ways. That's a seismic sea change for what we grew up with. Now, I know there was a player when I was growing up. His name was Woody Woodward. He had a long career. He was a terrible offensive player. Looking at the stats, maybe if you look at those stats now with these metrics, you'll see, well, no, he really wasn't that bad relative to either the other players at that position or the era or whatever. Right. But you know, usually batted just around the 210 mark. So, for us who were thinking about 300 was where you want to be, that wasn't a great thing. To continue with your epilogue. And when StatCast came along in 2015, it was the biggest of data, big data developments, exposing both the exposing both the average fan and the front offices to more precise ball tracking and player movement measurements. Now, that's another thing. It's not just for the fans, it's for the front office.
Right.
It's for their scouting. It's for them to determine the players in the minor league system, the players they have now, whether to tender offers for players in the option year, like Ryan Braun was just released, basically. I know that probably isn't the right technical term. He wasn't tendered. The Brewers didn't pick up his option.
Yeah.
So you wonder what's going to happen. I really felt sorry for players in that stage of their career this year because what's going to happen to them? You know, they're going to fade off into the sunset. Players in the minors who didn't even have a season, what's going to happen to them in their development? So talk a little bit about the front office viewpoint of these things.
Well, you know, every organization ultimately is going to have their own particular inputs. Every organization is using some kind of metric to get to something relative to wins above replacement. They might not call it wins above replacement, but they're evaluating players in a similar sense to where.
Excuse me one second. Does every team now have a department for statistical analysis?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And some bigger than others. But yeah, we've certainly gotten to the point where to not have that is pretty much malpractice. Now, how much you rely on that is up to you, you know, and the Nationals are an example of a team that, you know, they got billed as this kind of dinosaur kind of front office, which wasn't fair because they have an analytics department. They actually have their own internal database called Pentagon, which I think is pretty cool in DC. But again, it's like, how much weight do they put on the metrics versus other teams? Everybody's going to evaluate different things differently and value different things differently. And the Nationals showed a willingness to extend at bats and innings to older players, especially at bats. They had some older players who really stepped up for them and they valued experience and it worked out for them in 2019. It didn't work out as well in 2020, but you know, that's another conversation, but we are getting to a point in, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing to where those inputs are becoming more homogenous. We're seeing players evaluated very similarly from organization to organization. The data has just gotten refined enough to where that's just where it's headed. And a lot of people are coming from the same mindset. And so you see players sometimes left twisting in the wind who probably still have value they can provide to a ball club. You know, I'm a big proponent of you got to have the stats and you got to measure the heart or take both into account. You got to have the human side of the game still have some value. I think the Nationals in 2019 were an example of that to where there is something to be said for leadership. There is something to be said for veteran presence and that sort of thing. So how teams walk that fine line is ultimately up to them. I think we're seeing more and more teams go straight to the heart of the numbers as opposed to the heart of the person. And that's where you see, by and large, teams are more willing to go with the younger guy as opposed to the veteran guy. And, you know, they're not willing to pay for that experience the way they once did. So you're seeing average salaries coming down. And now, of course, in these circumstances that we're in right now, that's a whole other ball game where, you know, so many teams took a revenue hit in 2020. So that's, again, that's kind of getting into another conversation. But I do think there's value to the numbers, but there's also value to having your own individual mindset in terms of how you are going to evaluate a player. There's always going to be market inefficiencies in terms of, well, everyone's gravitating towards home runs in a given moment. We're going to gravitate as a team towards contact. And you know, the cycle will spin from there, I guess. But yeah, I do think there's some homogeny to how teams are evaluating players. And I think it's ultimately to the detriment of the players themselves.
The biggest thing these days, offensively at least, seems to be launch angle and exit velocity that I never even heard of prior to a couple of years ago.
Right.
And now there are books about it. There's coaching about it. You hear about little league teams and youth teams where the coaches are teaching that aspect of the game.
Yeah, right.
Just, you know, get out there, hit the ball, swing hard, and maybe something good will happen. Talk a little bit about one of the things that always fascinated me. Baseball, unlike other sports, the field is not the same all over the place.
Right.
And I always thought, I'm thinking Oakland has huge foul ground territory.
Right.
That a lot of balls that would make it into the stands on foul balls are in play and caught. So talk about park factor and how that enters into some of these statistics.
Yeah, that's a big one, because that plays into those plus stats like we were talking about earlier. And it is something that makes baseball special. You know, I mean, we know the size of an NFL field. We know the size of an NBA court, an NHL rink. Those stay the same from venue to venue. But in baseball, you know, a guy is going to have a different season in one park than he might have in another park. And Coors Field is, of course, the most extreme example of this, with the large outfield terrain and combined with the, you know, the atmospheric conditions that lead to more home runs and the outfield terrain that leads to more extra bases in general. It's a big deal. It's a big, big deal in baseball. It's not to be taken lightly. So, the park factors are stats that do take that into account and just demonstrate how specific parks play in a given season. Because it can change from year to year. I make the example in the book of the Rangers' former home, not Globe Life Field that we just saw in the postseason, but Globe Life Park. I think that's what they finally called it at the end there. Ameriquest Field had many names. The ballpark at Arlington had many names over its life. It had a major change. It was really viewed as a high offense environment for many, many years. And then they made a slight change in how their seating area suites behind the plate. I think they installed some glass, or they made some change back there, and it drastically changed the way the ball carried in that ballpark. You know, that small, I think they actually removed glass from a luxury club. I think that's what it was. And it changed the way that fly balls carried in that ballpark. So they went from a very famous hitter-friendly park to actually a bit more of a pitcher-friendly park. So the park factors can change from year to year, and they are weighed into these plus stats that I mentioned earlier to provide further context. Because again, much like, you know, a 30 home run season in 2019 is different than in 1992. A 30 home run season in Coors Field is different than a 30 home run season in, as you pointed out, Oakland Coliseum.
Getting back to something you mentioned before about the old fashioned stats, you write in the book about people like to have neat numbers. They like numbers that end, yes, in a zero or a five.
Right.
Getting back to the baseball card aspects, I don't think they do it anymore, but when I was a kid collecting, if you were a major, major star like a Mickey Mantle or a Willie Mays, you had a 100 card. 100, 200, 300. If you were like next level, then it was a 50, and
right,
then tens and fives. I don't think they do that anymore. So it's a little more confusing now.
Right.
You pick up a card, you flip it over, and 100 is like, you know, some third string shortstop for the Orioles. Are other countries as deep into these statistics as we are? Like in Japan, or Japan is probably the best example because they have the most developed professional leagues of probably any of the other foreign countries. Are they into this as much?
They're late adapters, but there is sabermetrics. They've become more popular in Nippon professional baseball, in the KBO. It's only natural because, again, I think when you kind of divorce yourself from the old school mentality of the round numbers, like you said, and when you start to see the original stats for what they are, they have some major flaws. And I'm not one of those people who advocates that we get rid of, you know, tabulating wins entirely, or, you know, don't even cite batting average, because it's all part of the picture. But I think if you open your mind to the idea that they're severely limiting factors with those particular stats, you know, you find some value in other ways to do it. And the round numbers, ultimately, advanced stats are not going to catch on the way, you know, batting average and home runs and wins did, because of that aforementioned affinity for round numbers. It's a different thing to be watching a ball game and know, okay, that guy just hit his 20th home run of the season, than it is to be watching the same game and see a guy make an out in the field and say, oh, his WAR just went up 0.06. You know, like, we don't know. We're not seeing it. We can't calculate that in real time. If you did, you'd be, you probably wouldn't be at a baseball game. You'd be off solving the world's problems, I would hope. So So from that standpoint, they're just not going to be as embraceable. That's why I tried to make this book as embraceable as possible and as fun as possible, because I know, like, ultimately, you know, math is not necessarily fun to the vast majority of the people, but it's more about taking the big picture view. And when you do take a step back at any juncture in the season, be it mid-season or at the end of the season, you know, these stats are just the way to go. I couldn't advocate for them in game, but I can advocate for them, you know, full season.
Well, one of the stats that is calculated within game is wins probability. And yes. I find that fascinating. Yeah. When I go through Baseball Reference and I go inning by inning, and they tell you after each at bat, and I'm sure they could even do it after each pitch, you know, what the win probability would be. So that's also an interesting chapter in the book. And none of this would be possible without a nod to, I mean, these ideas are not new. These ideas date back to Alan Roth and Branch Rickey,
yeah,
the Dodgers in the late 40s. And I'm guessing that they weren't, I mean, they obviously weren't embraced as these are now by the fact that no one's been talking about them in the intervening 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah, that's something that I actually got a greater appreciation for as I went to write this book. I went to write this book because I've had, again, my own progression with these stats in my time covering baseball, and I thought it was worth taking the reader on a similar progression. But I even knowing that, I didn't necessarily know the history of each individual metric. I knew kind of a vague thing. I knew, obviously, Bill James is extremely influential, and I'm very familiar with his work. And I knew that Branch Rickey, you know, was the basically the inventor of the modern farm system in Major League Baseball. What I did not know is just how ahead of his time his go-to statistician Alan Roth really was in the 1940s and 50s, because people thought on base percentage blew up with the Moneyball revolution, and it did, but they were calculating that way back then. It didn't become an official statistic for like 50 years after Alan Roth and Branch Rickey were first using it. So it just goes to show how ahead of the game they were. And, you know, they had, I put it in the book there. It was like one of the hardest things about the book was just writing this out to have it exact, the formula. I think he called it the formula for basically, you know, measuring team performance. And, you know, as opposed to just runs, it basically comes down to run differential, runs scored versus runs allowed. But they had this big lofty formula to demonstrate what goes in to a team's performance and how you evaluate it. And it's just amazing, you know, what those guys were looking at the time they were looking at it, because nobody was thinking like that at that time in baseball. And you look back now and you have such a great appreciation for where they were.
You talk about official stats. Are any of the stats in this book considered official stats these days? Is WAR an official stat?
WAR is not an official stat. And really, WAR, if you really want to get technical, WAR itself is not a stat. WAR is like, I describe it as like this Frankenstein of a bunch of different stats kind of molded into one for just a total addition, basically, of a bunch of different stats. And again, because it's calculated different ways in different places, it is not an official stat. It would be nice to get to some kind of industry agreement on what exactly should go into WAR. But, you know, different places have their own proprietary data, and you could understand why they'd want to have their own proprietary WAR as a result. They calculate defense differently, you know. And that's a big reason why there's a difference in the two WARs. And then pitching WAR, it's a big difference in terms of you know, how earned runs are calculated versus expected fielding independent pitching. So, you know, one model will use actual earned runs allowed. Another will use what a person's ERA logically should have been based on home runs allowed, walks allowed, and strikeouts achieved. So you can understand, I could see both sides of it. Yeah, it would be very nice to have one go-to WAR, but I don't know that we'll ever have an agreement, because there's different ways to get to that ultimate number.
Another thing that falls in a category of agree-disagree is defensive ratings. Yes. Especially with shift now, I always get a kick out of if the third baseman is playing in the second baseman's position while the second baseman is in short right field and the ball's hit to him and he makes the play, it's still 5-3 in your scorebook.
Right.
But it boggles my mind that this is – how is that calculated in zone ratings? Because he's way out of the zone for third base. And many years ago, I used to work for stats. I used to monitor the games. And it was our responsibility to determine how hard a ball was hit, where in the chart, in the grid of a baseball field was that ball hit. And now you can't really do that for certain positions.
I know. It's crazy because the defensive side of the game has changed so much. And while it has been changing, our defensive metrics have just gotten much, much better. I'm not saying they're perfect by any means, but it's certainly worlds above what it was even 10 years ago. And StatCast is a big part of that with the radar technology. So that plays into it. But yeah, you almost feel like for scoring, we should just have zones at this point, right? So if it's a ground ball to second, it's a 4-3. Even if it happens to be the third baseman or the shortstop who actually makes the play, you know, because at least that does a better job telling you what happened if you're just looking at how the game was scored. If you see,
but then do you have to divide the player up into, well, for this inning he was playing at third base, but over here he's playing second base.
Right, right. Yeah, so honestly, it's gotten to the point where I think the best defensive metric, and it's growing, and even at the time I was writing the book, it wasn't quite there. Is outs above average. So in the book, I use defensive runs saved and ultimate zone rating. And those are still the best in terms of having every defensive player involved. And there's video scouting that goes into how those stats are calculated. But even since I wrapped the book in late 2019 at MLB.com, we unveiled outs above average. We already had it for outfielders. And in early 2020, we unveiled it for infielders. And it does take infield shifts into account. So, you know, a player might accrue some of his outs above average while lined up in one position and others while temporarily shifted to another position. You can actually look at both of those. So just an example, like Nolan Arenado, third baseman for the Rockies, you know, he's going to get some of his outs above average at shortstop as opposed to third base. So when you look at his outs above average, you can actually fine tune it and see, you know, what was accumulated at third base and what was accumulated at shortstop. But that's probably the best way to do it right now. It's still not every position. We still don't have it for catchers, for instance. So we're getting there. You know, we're trying defense. I think the defensive component, when you mentioned earlier in my epilogue, how I said that, you know, the big sea changes in terms of scouting advanced analytics are probably all behind us. I believe that. I don't want to be one of those people that claims that, you know, everything new under the sun has already been done, but I do think the biggest things have already happened in terms of advanced analytics, but I do think there's still a lot of fine tuning to be done, and defense is easily, you know, the biggest place for that to occur.
I want to switch gears as we wrap this up. Talk about the act of putting this book together. Where did the idea come from? How did you find a publisher? What was it like working with the editor?
Yeah, the publisher found me. Sports Publishing had reached out to me about an entirely different concept. And we were batting around that idea. And but in the course of discussing it, we just started talking about just various trivia things. And you know, the editor made the point, you know, I used to, like, I know what a 300 hitter is. I don't know what a good wOBA is, like we were talking about earlier. I don't know what a good whip is. And it was his idea that maybe there should be a book that just defines that, you know, for the casual fan. I thought it was a great idea. There are other, there's certainly other books that explain stats and that sort of thing, but I did think there was a, you know, I hate to say it, but a for dummies model to be followed with this, because I just to make it relatable, because even my eyes gloss over it. I'm as locked into baseball coverage as you can possibly be. It's part of my job. It is my job. But I read some things where my eyes just glaze over because it starts to be a little too math heavy, and it starts to be harder to understand. So I think the ability to write something relatable that still relays, you know, these advanced concepts is important. And so I tried to write it that way, and just, you know, write a chapter here and there. I had to do it in the course of covering Major League Baseball on a daily basis for MLB.com. But it was fun to put it together because, again, I learned a lot doing it. as I said earlier, about the, where these numbers emanated from. And I think when you see the conversations that spark these ideas, it gives you a greater appreciation for where we are now.
And the book is A Fan's Guide to Baseball Analytics, Why WAR, WHIP, and WOBA and Other Advanced Sabermetrics Are Essential to Understanding Modern Baseball. As you can see from my copy, I did a lot of marking here. So it's a handy reference. It's a very enjoyable. It's a funny book. Highly recommend it. Anthony Castrovince, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Ron, thank you so much. I enjoyed it, sir.